Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim. Diane is back for the next edition of the Economist Mom segment. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The bipartisan effort to repair the broken budget process is now broken too. The Joint Select Committee on Budget and Appropriations Process Reform voted last week to reject the results of its almost year-long legislative attempt to overhaul how budgets and spending bills are written and considered. After 9 months of hearings and work sessions, the draft bill satisfied almost no one. Some critics called the bill weak, and even if it had passed, would not have changed anything. Others feared it was a legislative trap, a bill that could be prone to unwelcome amendments. House leaders abruptly pulled a Republican-backed tax package from last week's schedule. The bill, which would cost more than $54 billion over a decade, is perceived as a wish list of last-minute tax breaks and changes that House Republicans would like to pass before they lose the majority in January. It combines a revamping of the IRS with extensions of more than two dozen expired tax breaks and corrections to last year's tax code overhaul. The reason for the delay is not currently clear. Democrats have denounced the package, and since the measure was unveiled last Monday, it has gotten pricier. If the tax bill ever becomes law, Congress would have to pass a measure waiving a 2010 pay-as-you-go law that would trigger spending cuts to offset the loss of tax revenue. Fixing the pension crisis impacting millions of union workers with plans potentially running out of money by 2026 will take longer than a specially created bipartisan congressional committee was given. The Joint Select Committee on the Solvency of Multi-Employer Pension Plans did not make its statutory deadline Friday for completing its work. While they made, quote, significant progress toward a solution, more time is needed and the committee will continue its work. While legislation is still possible before the end of the year, missing the deadline and an expiring calendar suggests that a fix will come from a new Congress beginning in January. A compromise farm bill likely will not include a controversial provision pushed by House Republicans to expand work requirements for food stamp recipients. House and Senate negotiators have tentatively agreed to abandon the initiative, which Republicans saw as an attempt to encourage work and rein in costs in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The proposed agreement comes nearly 2 months after the most recent farm law authorizing agriculture and nutrition programs expired on September 30th. As the nation mourns the passing of President George H.W. Bush and honors his legacy, it's worth remembering his contribution in the area of fiscal policy as well. While he is most known on the topic for his popular catchphrase, quote, "Read my lips, no new taxes," during his 1988 campaign, the budget deal he signed in 1990, which he struck with the majority-holding Democrats on Capitol Hill, will likely go down as one of the more significant bipartisan achievements on fiscal policy in recent history. According to data compiled by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, the budget deal's deficit-cutting impact was $496 billion over 5 years and was equal to 1.4% of GDP. If applied to the CBO's projections of the size of the economy over the next 5 years, the comparable figure would be $1.6 trillion, an impressive and likely unrealistic figure in today's political environment. The tax increases in that package get most of the attention, but it also brought with it spending cuts and discretionary spending caps. Those caps weighed heavily toward defense, as President Bush helped secure a, quote, peace dividend at the end of the Cold War. Up next, economist Diane Lim will join me and Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby for the next edition of our Economist Mom segment. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by economist Diane Lim and Concord's executive director, Bob Bixby. Bob is on the show so much, we might as well call it Facing the Future with Bob and Chase. And Diane, a principal at the District Economics Group, is now a regular contributor in this recurring segment called The Economist Mom. Welcome back, Bob and Diane.
Thank you, Chase.
Thanks, Chase. I like your new title.
I thought you might. And it's always a pleasure to have you both on the show. We always get into some very deep and heady waters, and today will be no exception to that. We've spent the last several segments of The Economist Mom talking about past presidential administrations and even the current presidential administration and the type of fiscal and economic policies they pursued. We talked about President Clinton, President George W. Bush, President Obama, as well as President Trump. And I want to turn today to something sort of related to all of that and the climate surrounding fiscal and economic policy, and that is sort of the psychology of deficit financing or deficit reduction. Looking a little closer at this and breaking down this sort of cover your ears, tune out the contrary mindset that has taken over elected leaders and even the public at times. In fact, Bob, you had a special request for this particular segment, and it's a song by the one and only Bing Crosby. I think I'll play that now, and then you can jump in and tell us why you think it's of importance right now.
You got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. You got to spread joy up to the maximum, bring gloom down to the minimum, have faith or pandemonium, liable to walk upon the scene.
Okay, well, that's a
you didn't sing along.
No, that's I could do that if you wanted to.
I am a little disappointed that you didn't sing along.
Yeah, well, I mean, I used to as I was, you know, on the dance floor back in 1942 or something. Whenever a good blast from the past, not my past, but we were talking about the psychology of deficit reduction and why it's so difficult for politicians and the public to latch onto this, and it's because of this tendency to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative. And you know, that's fine in song, and it's a nice thing to think about. But when you're thinking about fiscal policy, it's not always good to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative, because you can get into big trouble. And I think that has something to do with why we're facing trillion-dollar deficits for as far as the eye can see right now. You want to have a fiscal policy that can withstand a stress test, so to speak, that if things don't go as well as you think, that you know, you won't run into a catastrophe. So planning a budget that accentuates the positive and is another way of putting that in budget parlance is a rosy scenario. If you're counting on a rosy scenario to make your numbers work, and the rosy scenario doesn't come to pass, the numbers are going to be even worse. And we've seen that happen, and it's always a danger. And I think it's very much a danger in the current environment.
And well, I could hearken.
Yeah, I was going to bring you in, Diane, because I wanted to point out you actually teach behavioral economics right now. So I figured you probably have some pretty great insight on this topic.
Yeah, so I was going to say, jumping in on what Bob was saying about the dangers of accentuating the positive and being optimistic in terms of budgets, it reminds me of George H.W. Bush is saying, well, that wouldn't be prudent. And it's really quite true that, you know, I think traditional economic theory would say we should have never been in this situation, because people should be rational about this and they should be looking over the long term, and they should see that the costs of deficit financing outweigh the benefits. But of course, in the real world, which we try to look at a little bit more closely in behavioral economics, we see that people tend to be much more short-sighted than traditional neoclassical economic theory assumes. And actually, when you look across cultures, across different countries, and the personal finance behavior of citizens all over the world, you see that Americans tend to not just be a little bit more nearsighted and living in the moment, but they also tend to be more optimistic, you know, and people would say that helps Americans be more entrepreneurial and take more risks. And, you know, we're at the frontier of so much economic development and success. And some of that comes from optimism. But when it comes to this deficit issue and government borrowing in particular, our optimism, sort of our over-exuberance and faith that the short-term economy can handle anything that we hand it, throw at it in terms of the long-term budget situation, becomes a risk. It becomes a problem. And, yeah, so I think that Americans are pretty optimistic. And they also, they have strong opinions about policies they like and policies they don't like. And they're fed this enthusiasm or this disdain for other policies from politicians. And there's a phenomenon in behavioral economics we call confirmatory bias, which is that once you've decided you're for something or against something, every new piece of information that comes your way, you will screen so that you will ignore the things that are contrary to your worldview and grasp onto with great gusto anything that supports your view. So people are very selective in how they read and process the news in terms of how it affects their point of view on terms in terms of fiscal policy, especially.
And you just said a whole bunch there, Diane, that I want to unpack a little bit before. But before we do that, I want to go back to Bing here. And Bob, can you explain for a second for our listeners what you view as the positive fiscal or economic policy and the negative right now that might be ignored by elected leaders?
Well, given the season, Chase, if I'm Bing, I might just go into White Christmas, but I'll refrain. Yeah, I think we can have a pretty good example right now by looking at the president's budget. It assumes 3% real, so to speak, inflation adjustment economic growth throughout the 10-year period of the covered by the budget, and it assumes that the president's policies are going to lead to that with lower taxes and lower spending, and that's going to lead to higher economic growth. And there really isn't a lot of economic theory to support that proposition, that not to the extent that the administration would like, that you can cut taxes by as much as the administration is hoping and get the sort of economic feedback that would lead to 3% growth, which is, you know, the CBO projects somewhere around 2%, say, or even lower, you know, 1.7 or 1.8 or something like that. And essentially, you have a lot of people taking a just doing what Diane just described, which was information bias, saying that we believe that this is going to happen, therefore we're going to base our policies as if it's going to happen, and information to the contrary, we don't want to hear about it.
Or they're going to take any good economic news and attribute it to the policies that the politicians supported. So there's a tendency to over-attribute economic movement when it's positive as something that was due to a particular policy, and to underplay or underemphasize any negative economic news, you disassociate it with the policy. So, for example, when the economy is doing great, when the stock market's doing great, you know, President Trump might say, oh, see, it's because of my tax cuts. And when GM decides to shut down plants, he might say it has nothing to do with his economic policies. That's just something we tend to see happen.
And it's not, you know, it's something that you find happens on both sides. But right now, that's an example. I can give you another example. After Obamacare was passed, healthcare costs in general slowed. They had, and so there were some
healthcare
in the administration.
Cost growth, right.
Yeah, they were saying, well, this is, let's see, look, Obamacare led to this or contributed to this slowdown in healthcare costs. And maybe it did, but it was part of a trend. It continued a trend that had been started before that. And people keep wondering, you know, there's, you know, what's causing the slowdown in healthcare cost growth. And so the, you know, the tendency might have been helped by what happened in Obamacare. It wasn't caused by Obamacare, but what the heck? If you're in office and something good is happening, why not attribute it to your policies?
Yeah, I don't know if any elected leader could avoid that tantalizing piece of information where, oh, something good happened under my watch. I think I'll claim it as a result of something I did.
Yeah, and I think we have to have allowances for that. But I think the problem is if you're going to make an assumption about some really good thing happening and then base your plans on that really good thing happening. Like, I'm going to buy a house I can't afford because I'm going to win the lottery on Tuesday.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. And I think the pendulum swings the other way with the negative as well. You know, and we haven't quite gotten too much into the negative that's being ignored at the moment, Bob, but you know, if you're willing to claim the positives that happened under your watch and you think your policies were the ones that got you there, then perhaps we should have a similar perspective when it comes to the negative. But to Diane's point, the opposite is usually true. It's, oh, well, it was my predecessor set this policy in place, and thus all these bad things are happening that I'm trying to combat.
Yeah, well, interest rates have started to come up. And, of course, you know, there's disassociation going on with, you know, it's not because of the deficit and the debt coming up. It's because the Fed isn't doing a good job, right? I mean, we're going to see that. When interest rates come down or when the stock market goes up, you know, the government tends to take, the administration and Congress tend to take credit for that. But when things go bad, they can always blame someone else, like the Fed.
It's easy to do because it with the economy, because there are lag effects to everything. Most things, unless you're in an immediate crisis situation, most things don't happen right away. So the things that we're concerned about, like long-term trends, don't kick in right away. And so it's easy to cite instances where you do take credit for the immediate, accentuating the positive, and find somebody to blame to eliminate the negative because mm-hmm. it was happened on somebody else's, you know, this is because of something that happened before, but anything that happens now happened because of my brilliance.
Mm-hmm. And the long-term stuff is always under the radar, radar.
Yeah.
So there's always all these new short-term immediate distractions popping up so that, you know, the long-term story about what deficits do to the long-term economy is really, it's just background noise, and the stuff that gets people's attention are the things that pop up every day on a daily or monthly or annual basis, not these sort of short-term or longer-term trends.
Yeah, an interesting example of all this sort of taking the good and trying to set the bad aside, and to point out the passing of former President George H.W. Bush. The nation is mourning the loss of him and his leadership and the character that he brought to the table. One of his biggest campaign pitches of the 88 cycle, I believe it was, whereas where he said, "Read my lips, no new taxes." And to his credit, 2 years later, he signed a budget deal that brought in new taxes. But not many people focus on that budget deal as one of his accomplishments. They always refer to that quote, "Read my lips, no new taxes." And oh, by the way, we're actually on a stronger fiscal footing than before and enjoying a nice peace dividend.
Right.
Well, George Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, is getting a lot of credit, and I think it's deserved credit, but it's retroactive credit for breaking that pledge. At the time, he was vilified within his party by some elements of his party, was given no credit by the Democrats. They didn't really stand up for him. It's not like they said, you know.
Right.
And of course, he was turned out of office a couple of years later. That wasn't the only reason, but I mean, it was certainly, you know, it gave a lesson to future presidents, which continues, unfortunately, to this
it
day,
yep.
that a bipartisan budget deal gets you in trouble. And that, to me, is a really dangerous lesson learned, you might say, from the 1990 budget agreement, which was, I think, just a matter of common sense. I mean, yeah, you had a burgeoning budget deficit, and you had a Democratic congressman and a Republican president. So what do? You compromise. That's not, that's not nuclear science or something. Mm-hmm. It's a common sense. And you fast forward to now, and, you know, nowadays they can't even pass a budget. They have to shut down the government for a few days or bump up against the debt limit before anybody will sign an appropriations bill. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not too much. It's just this inability to compromise, refusal to compromise, is really alarming.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim. In our now recurring segment, The Economist Mom, we're discussing the psychology of deficit reduction. I do want to sort of get back to that aspect of the topic here. And Diane, you mentioned earlier on that Americans are known for being optimistic and opinionated. And Bob, you just mentioned some of the more negative lessons learned, like if you're president, don't do a bipartisan budget deal or you get booted out of office. When you're teaching behavioral economics, Diane, do you talk at all about sort of the root causes of these issues, or do you just sort of acknowledge that they're there and, you know, that's the lens in which you view policy?
Well, one of the things we talk about in behavior a lot is how important context and framing matters for how people understand issues. So the deficit, the federal budget issue, is an example of one where most people, most ordinary Americans, don't really understand the issue. And because it's kind of a, you know, an abstract issue, we talk about why it's a problem for our economy in terms of debt to GDP being too big of a burden on our economic resources. So a lot of what the reason why the deficit is not an issue, an important priority for members of Congress, is because it's not a big deal for their constituents, the people that vote for them in office. And so they're much more likely to attract support if they propose tax cuts or benefit increases than if they were to propose the opposite, tax increases or benefit cuts. And so politicians just are going along with the fact that politically they get all these signals all the time that it doesn't pay off for them politically. It does them harm to come out with fiscally responsible policy platforms. And you saw that happen with George H.W. Bush. I think that's the last time we had a lot of really good bipartisanship in terms of support for a tax increase, at least, because, you know, I think when it happened in the Clinton administration, it wasn't with bipartisan support. So I think that it's just changed so much in terms of the climate on the Hill, in terms of the partisanship. A member of Congress's first inclination when they're trying to come up with a position on a policy is not what position has a chance of getting some support from the other side of the aisle, but it's rather what position can we take that really makes the other side look bad to the American public, what makes us look good and the other party look bad, rather than what can we do that makes both of us look good. It's like they've abandoned that notion of good government coming from both parties, and they've started to view it as a contest, like one will win and one will lose. And so we're just going to make sure if we're at one party, in one party or the other, that our side looks good, and we're going to throw bombs over at their political bombs over to their side.
And to me, that's incredibly frustrating. And you know, this whole environment is somewhat ironic because you think, well, the elected leaders want to do what will get them reelected, and people want tax cuts and less responsibility and less things to worry about. But we're all in this huge mess that we're currently experiencing, which is growing deficits and a massive national debt and an inability to invest in the future of our country. So here's my question for both of you. How do you get the American public to, in a sense, eat their spinach on these issues and look beyond just accentuating the positive?
I I think it's
the silence is saddening.
Well, I was just staring at Bob like, do you have an answer for that? Yeah.
Well, Chase, it's kind of like asking, what is the meaning of life? You know what I mean?
Hey, read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I believe the answer is a number.
Look, obviously there's no easy answer to that. I mean, I think people need to feel the need for that sort of action. It's very difficult. Paul Tsongas used to talk about that the mission of the Concord Coalition should be to change the wind direction, that Congress would only Congress is like a weather vane on top of the barn, and it would blow in the direction of the prevailing winds. And you couldn't just go up to the weather vane and try to talk the weather vane into changing course. It would be an unproductive conversation. So that was why he said we needed to have a presence outside of Washington, that people need to feel like that is a problem to the country's future, and which it is, and that they need to demand politicians to do something substantive about it. But when there are other concerns that are, you know, on people's top of people's minds, as there often are, it's difficult to generate that immediate concern about something that's probably going to have its most severe consequences somewhere down the line.
Yeah, I think our current politicians, our leaders, they just waste so much time and energy fighting with each other about things that are really tinkering around the edges. And the frustrating thing is that there hasn't been, like, I just think that there hasn't been something to kind of force everyone to just snap out of it. It's like, you know, this is kind of silly, the things that they fight over, when there are big, serious issues, that it would be much more productive, much more efficient for our policy leaders, our policymakers, to focus on the bigger things, which do require bipartisanship, and not waste so much time and money fighting over the little things. And it often feels like they're fighting over window dressing or, you know.
Because it's easier. I mean, that's
another
element of accentuating the positive is it's much easier and more fun to fight over little things than to try to solve big problems.
Yeah, it's like hand waving. It's like they're saying, look, we're doing something. We're doing something.
Yeah, and, you know, and so, and it's just, you don't, I mean, I guess that's part of convincing people that you're doing something without actually doing anything.
Yeah.
And we all get caught up in these little fights and these short-term things, and like government shutdowns are usually about fairly minor things, not about the larger issues.
Well, and I want to piggyback off of that commentary that it's easier to ignore the issues and go way back to something Diane said earlier in the show. And that was, she brought up the concept of a confirmation bias, you know, being willing to only look at the information that reaffirms really your own belief. And I had a really interesting situation happen this week on Facebook, of all places, because social media is apparently where everyone goes to dialogue, or at least, you know, share their opinion and move on. I kept seeing this meme pop up about Social Security and what were being proposed as facts. And being someone who focuses on those issues, I noticed that they weren't actually facts. And I pointed that out in a comment, which I seldom do because it usually doesn't lead to good things. And what happened was about 30 seconds later, that person unfriended me from Facebook because I commented with, hey, why don't you consider these facts?
You push back.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how do you, and this is how I'll bring it back home here. In your classes, when you're teaching behavioral economics, or when you're talking to your peers or talking to your fellow mothers, because we're, you know, this is called the economist mom, how do you break past that confirmation bias? How do you get people to look beyond just their initial vantage point and what they're willing to hear in order to maybe consider an alternate reality for them?
Well, it's very difficult. I wanted to point out that Facebook actually encourages confirmation or confirmatory bias, because Facebook can keep track of what you like and what you don't like, and they'll feed you more and more of what you like.
Yeah.
So, you know, all the social media stuff is actually very polarizing because of the algorithms that the social media programmers actually use to feed you content. In terms of, I mean, just my personal perspective on, like, I am very cautious. You know, I have friends on Facebook that are have political views that are very extreme, and I am very wary from engaging with them at all, especially if I have a good relationship with them otherwise. But personally, I think you engage with people and you try to kind of have a reasonable conversation with someone. One way that I think is a possible strategy is to engage with someone about something you agree on first. Like find a touch point with that person first that might not be on that issue that you want to engage with them on in terms of issue where there might be some disagreement initially. I think it's sort of the way that Congress has to start working together. They can't start with the hard issues where they obviously are very polarized, like issues about tax policy and how high the average tax rate should be. Like they would never, clash on that forever. But if members of Congress could start working on issues that are easier to come to bipartisan agreement on, I think that's, you have to find an in with someone and then start to broaden the set of things you can work on together. But I think you always start with something easy and then you work your way up to something that's harder. And, you know, so I would never talk to another mom who is obviously has a very different view of policy than I do. I would never start by saying, well, here are all the facts that and everything wrong with what you just said on Facebook. Yeah. I would first start by saying, oh, your kids are so, you should be so proud of your kids. So, you know, you start with something that connects you. And then you kind of test the waters to see, well, can I actually tell her that this thing that she's like really, focused on in terms of a political issue is not actually accurate? Like she's citing this fake news site and, you don't want to do it. Facebook is a very touchy place. People get really offended. They do take it personally, right? It's a personal website. Right. Pretty much. And so when even if a friend of yours who's a friend for some other reason other than you make policy together, if a friend of yours says the thing you just posted is fake news and, you know, how can you be so stupid as to think that this is real? Yeah, that it's not. People get very bent out of shape.
It wasn't that bad of a comment. That was very cordial. But right. I guess to put it in perspective, when you consider social media and sort of the megaphone it gives you, it's if you were to equate it to real life, I guess it would be like me sort of randomly walking up to this person on the sidewalk and saying, how could you believe this about Social Security or something like that? And and to me, like that's probably a really good point to keep in mind what you just said, Diane, and that's finding the initial common ground before going right for the jugular on a contentious issue. It's something I probably should have done. Maybe I would still be a Facebook friend with that person.
So you need to find the equivalent. Find the equivalent of posting really cute dog videos on Facebook. Like, so whatever the equivalent of that is in terms of engaging with people in a friendly
way. I don't think there are any cute statistics.
Especially right now.
I agree with that. I mean, I think that the, frontal assault never work on that sort of thing because it's challenging somebody's integrity and their being. So I would draw a distinction between somebody that's being disingenuous and you know they're being disingenuous and somebody who really believes something that happens to be wrong or you think it's based on insufficient or false material, because if you say to somebody, you're wrong, and that's the first thing they hear, there is kind of a defensive crouch that is sort of a natural that everybody goes into. But, I look at it when we get feedback from the Concord Coalition newsletter or articles, things that we put out, and people will come back, and I'm certainly much more receptive, and I kind of enjoy the response that says, gee, I really like your newsletter. It's good, Have you considered that, and this comment here, have you considered that blah, 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 and maybe citing some other information, you can sort of engage with somebody as opposed to the people that will respond, in a very negative way and just basically accuse you of having improper motives or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, because those ones you just put in the trash because they're not looking to get into a discussion or something. So Yeah, I mean, this is really difficult, not just on social media, but I think in engaging as members of Congress in any sort of negotiation. You know, when I was on the Rivlin-Domenici Commission, for example, when people were going back and forth about the wisdom of various policies, you know, if you kind of legitimize the, if you acknowledge the that somebody is has the integrity of their views or something like that, that's just crazy. And you get into a dialogue with somebody who just happens to have a different viewpoint, that's the way to try to get a negotiation. Unfortunately, there just isn't enough of that going on. It is more an exchange of facts going back and forth like trench warfare without any invitation to engage in a colloquy. It's just...
Mm-hmm. I mean, haven't they talked about... People have talked about how members of Congress, their relationships with each other are different than they used to be decades ago. And some of it is because they don't spend enough time here and be together, right?
I think that's probably
true.
So
I think they have to have... They have to develop personal relationships and friendships with each other first before they can get into these discussions of and trust each other to have, you know, well-motivated discussions about these tough policy issues.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense to me. I think all of this part of our conversation actually reminds me of a movie from my childhood, What About Bob?, which actually was the setting was Lake Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire. But there was a scene in there where Bob is trying to get on a bus, and he keeps saying baby steps, you know, down the sidewalk, baby steps toward the bus door, baby steps onto the bus. And I feel like that's where we are, both as a country and politically. We almost need to have that baby steps mentality of finding the common ground first on the little things so we can work our way up to tackling the big things. And maybe that can start today. Maybe that can start with January, where we have a period of divided government. Who knows? But I hope it's soon. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim during the Economist Mom segment. We touched on the psychology of deficit reduction and fiscal policy as a whole. Thank you for joining the show once again, Diane and Bob.
Thanks, Chase.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. This week, it's more a set of facts that leads to a question that needs to be answered, and that question is, how much defense spending is needed? A bipartisan commission recently released a report filled with alarming language about the country's ability to defend itself against China, Russia, and other threats. The commission said that the security and well-being of the United States are at greater risk than at any time in decades. The commission was appointed by Congress to review the Trump administration's national defense strategy. The commission also said that, in part because of inadequate funding, American military superiority had, quote, eroded to a dangerous degree and might struggle to win or perhaps lose a war against China or Russia, especially if it had to fight on two or more fronts at the same time. Given the commission's bipartisan composition and emphatic language, the Trump administration and members of Congress have a responsibility to carefully review the report and consider its recommendations. Such a review, however, should not rest entirely on the report and should consider some additional helpful context. For example, the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, in a recent presentation on U.S. defense costs, refutes the notion voiced by many in Washington that defense funding in recent decades has been stingy. The CBO examined the size of the Defense Department budgets from 1980 through the current fiscal year, accounting for differences in the size of the military, the department's basic budget, which excludes U.S. war costs such as those for Afghanistan and Iraq, and determined that it had increased substantially over that period in inflation-adjusted terms. CBO said its analysis of individual portions of the defense budget indicates that the cost increases are broad-based, including increases in personnel costs, operations and maintenance costs, and costs to develop and purchase weapon systems. It also identified three major contributors to increasing defense costs.
First, compensation costs for military personnel have been rapidly increasing since 2000. This includes the Defense Department's health care costs, which CBO says have roughly doubled since then. Second, the costs of operation and maintenance per active duty service members have been steadily increasing for decades. The third factor, new weapons systems are often more expensive than the ones they replace. This seems like fertile ground for further discussion, frankly. Why, for example, have lawmakers in the past blocked reasonable efforts to help rein in healthcare costs at the Pentagon? Are there better ways to encourage technological advances that would save money? And somewhat unrelated, why is the Pentagon's own assessment concerning unneeded infrastructure being ignored? In evaluating the Pentagon's base military budget, it is also important to note that the Defense Department has long boosted that budget through the misuse of special funding that is theoretically supposed to be used for overseas military operations. Such special funding is not subject to congressionally approved spending caps. Another concern that should be taken into account is the Pentagon's poor performance in its first comprehensive audit, and the fact that this poor performance did not come as a surprise to many analysts and Pentagon officials themselves when it was released earlier this month. Federal law has long required audits of the Pentagon and other parts of the government. The deadline for the Defense Department audit, however, had been repeatedly postponed, and that was obviously a mistake. Circling back to the beginning of this segment, even the bipartisan commission that urged significant additional funding for defense acknowledged the need for many improvements in the Pentagon and the administration's national defense strategy, including bringing the Pentagon's culture and way of doing business into the 21st century. The commission also said that even with the recent boost in military funding and anticipated improvements at the Pentagon, Congress should consider abandoning budget caps and boosting the basic defense budget by 3% to 5% beyond inflation in the coming years. That would be an extremely ambitious goal given the larger fiscal picture and probably ill-advised if such a move is not paid for. With large and rapidly rising federal debt, an aging population, unsustainable mandatory spending programs, an inefficient tax system, and other pressing national priorities. In addition, defense already claims a large share of federal, quote, discretionary spending. Military leaders and elected officials in Washington have a responsibility to ensure that money sent to the Pentagon is being well spent. To help them do so, the problems reflected in the comprehensive audit should be addressed as quickly as possible. Congress, which has repeatedly rejected past efforts to curb the rise in military personnel costs, must consider reasonable reforms in that area, particularly health care. Priorities in the military budget must also be set with sharp cuts to non-essential programs. If careful study leads members of the next Congress to believe that large military funding increases are in fact needed, they should find a responsible way to pay for them. Simply borrowing more money is not the answer. As various analysts have pointed out, a runaway federal debt should also be considered a severe national security problem. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.